All right, folks, we are back on the Flexic.com T-Talk podcast. Stefan Tiedorf here, as per usual, with my, as per usual, co-host, Scott McLeod. How's it going,
how you doing,
Scott?
It's going well. Cold day.
What'd you get up to this week? Anything special?
Oh, not much.
Here in Ontario?
Yeah, that was the thing. It was like prepping for a big storm. That's about it. So just puttered around the house, watched some golf. Nothing too exciting. Worked a little bit on the cave, and yeah.
Yeah, where are we at with the cave? I need to hit some balls here. I'm itching.
I'm probably still a couple weeks away from my simulator at home, getting that all done. So lots of little details and things like that. And a few things that are out of my hands, unfortunately. So
buying a house, is this the most expensive purchase in your life, doing this entire thing?
Ooh, that's a good
point. It's got to get close there.
Yeah, I would say it's close. I would say, because it's in the it's in the range, obviously, for a vehicle. So, I would.
A nice vehicle, Scott. We ain't talking a Pontiac Sunfire here.
Exactly. So, yeah, it probably is. After my house, it's probably my biggest investment I've ever made, short of my when I was in a business. As far as a retail business at one point.
Well, I mean, I think it does. Maybe it does add retail value, resale value to the house if you find the right person, I guess. But I don't think you're going anywhere now. I think you're stuck. This is your forever.
I might be living in that garage soon. I might be. But I mean, it's just kind of funny now because it goes from being a garage to, you know, all of a sudden I walk out of my kitchen, go down five steps, and I turn right into a room, as opposed to the garage. So it just feels different. And obviously that'll eventually be, the simulator. So that, yeah, a little bit different, something to get used to, but I think I can get used to it.
Fair enough. Yeah, I had a decent week. In-laws were here for a lot of the week, which is fine. You know, having the in-laws around, they're not around often. Need to see my wife. We're on that final stage of a pregnancy, and they haven't seen her in a while. I get it. But My father-in-law is a talker before coffee guy. Nice. And I don't know about you, and I have traveled together. I think we do a good job of not saying anything until first coffee's done. We're very, both you and I need coffee. Yeah. We'd be good roommates in the fact of like, hey, get up morning, head nod. But no, my father-in-law, Rick, he wants, you know, woke up Monday or Sunday, Sunday morning, wake up and got waiting for the coffee to get ready. And he wants to get right into Jordan Spieth. Can he get it done? Oh, I think he's going to get it done today. And it's like, Rick, I need like 30 minutes and then we'll talk Jordan Spieth. And then Monday, same thing. It's like, oh, I thought he was going to do it. And he ultimately didn't, obviously, but
yeah. Do you feel cornered in some of those conversations? Because I know I've had it over the years. I mean, I God willing, I have some great neighbors, but you know, there's a few of them that, you know, if Tiger is in the contention and doing something, they want to talk Tiger, and they will literally come up five driveways if they see me getting out of my vehicle to come talk about Tiger Woods.
If people know you're in golf, there's two things they do. One, they want to talk to you about the one golfer they know, or if they're really into golf, they want to know your opinion on certain equipment that comes out, if you think it will fix their game that you have no idea what their game looks like, and then on top of it, what price you get it at. My experience so far.
I would add a third element to that. I have the other one where all of a sudden I'm outside and I see my neighbor pull in and he's got his set of golf clubs and he's played his, you know, one of his two rounds a year, and he wants to tell me all 162 shots.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I haven't got that yet. I have a new neighbor. Different situation will go in. So I'm working yesterday or Tuesday, and I hear someone shoveling outside. And a brand new neighbor, they just moved in. I'm like, what's going on? So dog runs up barking. And this guy, new neighbor, young guy, he's shoveling my driveway and my steps. And, you know, you think, great guy, right? Awesome guy. But my brain went from great guy, awesome guy to like, where does this end? Because this is day one. Like, this is day one of our relationship. Like, by summertime, I'll be up there reshingling this guy's roof. You know how it is, right?
Like, there's escalation.
It's the game. Like, you know, it's the back and forth. It's a great game to have, but who goes, like, how far does it go? So how to go out and introduce ourselves and the whole nine yards and meet the whole family and, you know, give it, like, probably a month and we'll probably be having dinner together. And, you know,
you'll be making them dinner.
And I appreciate it because I don't know about you. We haven't even talked golf. We don't need to right now. I don't know. What is your driveway like for in terms of shoveling? What's your routine?
I was out the other morning because obviously we had a good dumping of snow here, 25 centimeters or whatever the case was. I went out at 6 a.m. to do it just so my wife could get out of the driveway to get to school. So I just go out, do the side of the house first, head down, try to do the top part of the driveway first in the hopes that one of my neighbors with their snowblower might do the end. Yeah. Right. Do one of those. And then the expectation is that by mid-afternoon, if I'm working from home, I'm probably going to have to go up there again. And that happened the other day because, you know, the snowplow driver, thankfully, they did the street. I'll give him credit for that. But when they went by our house, he must have been going faster than a NASCAR car because the spray of snow that went into my driveway was probably 8 feet into my driveway at about 2.5 feet high. So I ended up doing more snow afterwards in the cleanup than I probably did the first time I cleaned up.
Sorry, are you a guy though that like can't have anything on? Have you reached that old man status where it's like there cannot be a speck of snow on this driveway?
No, not one bit. It's scrape it, get it done. And yeah, I've got one neighbor like that if you look over it, you know, it looks like it's summer.
Yeah. I don't get those guys. But this guy just cool. Like my neighbor two doors down, this guy must just hate me and just think I'm a despicable human. Cause I called it a speed bump at the end of my driveway where like it got too big and then like it's just got packed down and there's clearly an ice layer that you know, I just want to make sure people aren't flying into my driveway. That's what I've been saying. I'm not going to get
speed bump.
Yeah, so I got a little speed bump there. I'm very much like minimal. I don't really care. Like, this isn't adding value to anything. I don't care if you don't like the look of
just
my
driveway. Just make sure you can get in the driveway.
Can I get in and I get out of the driveway? Exactly. Yeah. And that's where I'm at with mine.
I'd be interested to know from listeners what category they're in. Are they the person that has to grind it right to the bottom? Or do they just kind of take care of it enough that they can get in and out? And, you know, there's got to be a focus group out there.
Yeah. I like to believe I'm setting up chalet vibes when you come to deliver Amazon packages. That you're walking through the big snow, and you're like, wow, I feel like I'm in Mont Tremblant in a chalet. I don't want summertime driving. That's what summer's for, right?
So yeah, there you go.
Why don't we talk golf?
Sure, why not?
It's been 8 minutes or whatever it is. I like that. Throw that poll out at some point over the next week and see what our listeners like. I bet you I'm in the minority, especially like with golfers. You get a lot of older golfers. They're going to tell me I'm lazy. It's not that I'm lazy. It's that I just don't care. It's from the Office Space. But let's hit our birdie, par, bogey for the week of golf. Throw an honorable mention in there. Scotty, what's your birdie for the week that was?
Oh, I'm going to say my birdie for the week has to be the USGA hiring Mike Wann as their new CEO, their upcoming CEO. He's going to replace Mike Davis. They had an official announcement today, press conference today as well. You know, Mike Wann's done a great job in the last 11 years at the LPGA. He is going to do a very effective job at the USGA. And the reason I say that is he is a guy who goes in, and as he says, he's the guy who can really put the huddle together. He's not the guy who's going to always just execute the plays. And this is what he says. He's like, you know, he worked for Wilson. He worked for TaylorMade. So he knows the equipment side of things, LPGA. He started his golf career as a teenager working on a grounds crew and that aspect of the game. So as he said, he's come full circle now. He knows a lot of people in a lot of different aspects of the game. He's willing to collaborate with a lot of people. And I think that's what they need. They need to not come out and be the authority. You know, they're obviously going to have their rules and regulations and how they're going to do things, but they have to be open to discussion to other stakeholders in the game. And that's important for their reputation. So I think Mike Wann, big birdie for him being the new USGA CEO later this summer.
Yeah, I hope he doesn't get stuck in the history of this is what the USGA does, right? Yeah. Like, I really hope he doesn't, because that's what he was great as with the LPGA as the commissioner.
He actually addressed that. Actually, he said it on his notebook. He actually has a saying that's on his notebook, and he said about, respect history, but don't be afraid to make it.
Yeah. And I hope
I like
and
that.
The USGA has made a lot of history for a lot of the wrong reasons over the years. So hopefully he can swing that in the right way. I think I would love to see him make some fight against this whole where the USGA has gone with equipment. We'll see. It seems like we're I love Rory's comments over the last week about it. Like, what a waste of money this seems like, but we don't need to dive too much into that as it's still up in the air. But I would like to see him make some changes to some events. Like, let's not get US Opens getting away from you. I thinking back over the weekend, I'm going down a different tangent. The last US Open might have been the worst one I've ever watched. Come to think about it. Just the setup from a standpoint. Like the reason why it comes from that equipment talk, right? Of like the ball going too far. Mm. Everyone was missing the fairways that week, right? So there, because the fairways were so thin and the rough was so long that obviously Bryson won, right? Because like if you're going to miss the fairway and everyone's going to miss the fairway, the real advantage is the super, super long hitter, right? So looking back, just it was so bad. I just hope we don't have that type of mindset. I love the idea of the US Open being difficult, but like, not to that point where it's almost becoming a gimmick. I mean, maybe I'll get slack for that, but that's what I'm feeling. I think he's done a great job with the LPGA, forward thinking, trying different things. I hope he brings that to the USGA. It's just not what they're known for, of trying to be different.
No, and it's not. And they are an association. It's not like, even though he's the CEO, it's not like it's a dictatorship.
He's got a board.
Yeah, exactly. He can't just go in there and wave a wand and make things, change. But, you know, he can have an influence, and he can also provide the direction and make them realize and understand how cooperative they have to be with the other stakeholders, and not just to, put a line in the sand and say, this is it. This is what we are. We're the USGA we're nothing else. So I think he wants to change the look at it. I think there is a good team. There's a good core of people that in there that work for the USGA. I just think, having his influence in there can be nothing but positive.
I agree. And just quickly,
how about you? What's your birdie?
Well, I was just going to say quickly, I have a pet peeve for the week, and I don't know who needs to hear this, but you are not a CEO unless you report to a board of directors.
Exactly.
I need like the amount of people I see these days, and I get
a lot on social media.
Yeah, there's a ton on social media that are CEOs. You're not a CEO. You're an entrepreneur. An entrepreneur is cooler than being a CEO. Yeah. Way harder than being a CEO, and a CEO will tell you that. Just need to get that. It's been bugging me. Clearly I'm in a mood today. Like I've went off about coffee and snow and nothing about golf. But let's get into golf. Birdie for the week. Back-to-back weeks of great golf. I believe this week the AT&T, and I said it, it's going to be a great event because we don't have the dumb amateurs around ruining Pebble Beach for me. I think they hit record numbers, best numbers for a non-major event on any network over the last 2 years. So that was really cool to see. I loved the coverage. It was a great golf tournament, basically right until the end when Nate Lashley blew up. And I'm going to get to him at some point here, believe me.
Oh, are we?
So it was a great tournament. I really loved it. I love Pebble Beach. I want to see it more. Yeah. Great tournament. I thought the conditions were great. But my true birdie for the week is actually going to Cameron Smith's new haircut. If you haven't seen it yet, you can find it anywhere, Twitter, social media, Golf WRX.
It's amazing.
It is a hockey haircut, like a junior hockey player's haircut. Shaved the sides, went short up top, long in the back, pure mullet. This is what I love, because the PGA Tour, and if you ever go to a PGA Tour event, you get inside the ropes, and I'm not being like, oh, I've been inside the ropes. Just go to an event, and you can get a vibe very quickly, and one of the biggest differences from the PGA Tour to the LPGA is this. These guys take themselves way too seriously. Too seriously. I get they play for a whole lot of money, but you do not need to take yourself that seriously, regardless of what you do. The LPGA, they're way more down to earth, and just seeing a guy like that just be like, hey, who cares? This is funny. Yeah. I think it's funny, so I'm going to do it. And I pure birdie. It's going to create content. You know he's getting interviewed this week at Riviera. And what? I'm going to say this. First round leader this week will be Cameron Smith.
Just because of the haircut.
That's a vibe right there.
Yeah.
For all the kids, I'd
love to see it. I mean, yeah, you're right. Yeah. For other people to be attracted to the game and see something different and have something to talk about. Something that's just fun to talk about, really, more than anything.
Yeah.
There's no controversy in it or whatever. Let's just enjoy it.
And not everyone can look like Adam Scott. right? Like Cameron Smith without that haircut, he might be like a 5 out of 10. He's not like, you know, he's not, he's not Adam. He's not Adam, which like an Australian 10 out of 10, whatever. With that haircut, you know, he's getting looks. People are going to be sniffing around. I think he's going to, he's at a rich club this week. I love the timing too. Like Riviera, like, is there a snootier LA golf club that's just
yes, there is.
But you know what I mean? Like it's got that private club, but what a great golf. I'm really excited for this week, and we'll get to that later. I think it's a great golf course. I've been playing it a lot on PGA Tour 2K21. And just quickly, I was on it last night, and John, who we had on the podcast, who does all the audio for it, he plays this game like every night. So we ended up getting a little chat about, he's like, oh, it's just mindless. I throw on some podcasts and play, and that's what I've been doing lately, just playing a bunch of rounds, throwing some podcasts, and reach out to me. Let's play.
So when are we subscribing to your Twitch channel? Are you are you live streaming or what?
Have you seen
some of those guys?
Yeah, no, I saw the Barstool dudes were doing a like
I don't care about them, but
no, but they were doing like a YouTube live stream, and they actually brought some people in to play with them, and they were doing like an alternate shot stuff, which is better than actually playing golf with those two morons. But
well, I think it's funny because I saw a couple of the Facebook gamers or whatever, and these guys are all
Facebook
like
Facebook gamers.
Yeah,
you just made yourself sound so old.
No. They've got a whole channel now that Facebook is their whole element of gaming now or whatever.
Oh, okay, now maybe I'm the old guy. There's gaming a revenue, on Facebook.
Yeah, okay. Totally. That's a revenue stream.
Farmville?
No. They literally, it's basically a competition for Twitch. Basically the same type of thing.
Okay, cool.
Streaming channel. You can put in money, get stars, you know, apply it to these people just like you would on Twitch as far as donating and stuff to them or whatever. But some of the people playing, they're hilarious. Like the one guy dresses up like a golfer, obviously. And I don't think he is.
Glove on?
I think he's a Canadian. I don't know if he has a glove on, but he's definitely decked out. And he's the guy whose everything is coordinated. You know, the hat, the shirt, the whole deal or whatever. And I think he's from Vancouver. And there's this other guy who's like this dreadlock stoner dude or whatever like this, who, you know, has probably never been on a golf course in his whole life, but you know, he plays the game.
Oh, shoots falling 20 every round
probably. Yeah, he's a character, and you know, people are shooting stars his way or whatever like that. But it's an interesting culture to dive into and just kind of look at, so good luck with that.
Let's play sometime. Anyone out there that's playing, let's play. Let's hook up. Let's get a society going. Maybe we'll get a Tea Talk Society out there.
There you go.
We'll do a tour. Actually, quickly, there's a golf course around this area called Rivendell. Someone has created Rivendell on that game, and it is like perfect. It's insane because Rivendell is a good cottage golf course.
Yeah.
Right. It's very much in the middle of nowhere in a very small town north of Kingston area. And the fact that someone probably put like at least 50 hours into this thing to make it's perfect. And
well, this
so
is
the, Equinel's the, on there as well. And I played that one a bunch, and I'm hitting it in places I'll never hit it on the golf course. So that's fun. But yeah, it's crazy that people that
there's definitely a whole culture within the golf club TGC and PGA Tour K21, and I'll see it all the time now because I'm involved with seeing things that our guys are doing. For some of the guys are doing TGC 19 on their simulators, playing that as well. There's guys that are basically all they do is build golf courses. They're for hire.
Yeah.
And so they'll say, hey, I'm for hire if you want a golf course built. And a lot of golf courses will want their own course built, much like, you know, you'll see on TrackMan and other things that golf courses get built. You know, you can play Glen Abbey on certain simulators, stuff like that. And obviously TGC has got, I don't know, 100 and some odd thousand courses now, right?
Yeah, it's crazy. I know our guy, Andy McWilliams, helped him build your simulator there. He built his own golf course on his TrackMan. And I remember he posted about it, told me about it. It's like, you play that golf course all year. Why wouldn't you want to play something different in the winter? Like, you can play anywhere in the winter. But hey, that's where it is. We're getting way off track here.
Yeah,
Scotty, what's your par for the week?
My par for the week is actually just starting to see data now come out, real data on golfers for last year and play in golf. Had some concerns. A couple of golf pros that I talked to, and I may have mentioned it last week, that were talking about, you know, did we just see a big burst in play of players that are already playing? How many new golfers are happening? So trying to keep a look at some of the metrics and stuff that are out there. And again, it's not a great thing or it's not a negative thing, but it's just what's happening. First Data is coming out of Germany, and Germany's a whole different situation. Germany is a place where people have to be a registered golfer there. You have to do a rules test. You have to do a playing test, and wow, you get to be part of the association. So their numbers showed that they were up 1.9%, about 9,000 new registered golfers in 2020. But again, I think starting to see this data is going to be very helpful for people in the industry to make real decisions, because I'm talking to golf courses all the time, some of them now that are saying, you know, we're going to start to restrict our juniors because we want, you know, our full playing members to have time because we couldn't get access last year. Talking to other ones that say, hey, you know, we think we're still going to be busy at the start of the year, but by the time we get to July, I think it's going to be a little bit back to more what normal was before, because people are going to be able to access their cottages and stuff. So just this information starting to come out, I think it's a good thing, and people are going to be able to make proper decisions based on it.
Yeah, I like that's a perfect par where it's you don't know where we're going, right? It could be good, it could be bad. You know, they're looking on both sides of it, so that's cool. My par of the week is very much in the same vein. It's Phil Mickelson's career options is my par of the week. This kind of came out throughout the last week. One of his business partners said, you know, we're always in discussions about Phil's future. Wouldn't surprise me if in the next 12 to 24 months you might see more of Phil on the air. I think that's a good idea for Phil to get on the air. I think it's great for TV. I think he's going to bring something different. No one's going to be able to tell him what he can and cannot say because he's Phil, right? Like, you can't tell this guy. He's going to bring a whole new element. He was great in the match. He was great in the match two. He was great in the match three, four, five, six that are probably going to come out. You know, this is like he's adding that to his resume. I think he'd be great for TV. Hear me, him and Bones together on a broadcast. How cool would that be?
I think the only thing I'm wondering is, you know, what a couple of the articles and things surmised. One, how many events will he do? And two, will a network, you know, come up with enough scratch to make it interested? So
absolutely. Think about CBS sends Tony Romo $20 million a year to do what, work 18 weeks, 20 weeks of the year. You give Phil five for golf, which is a smaller market. Like you have to, is it a quarter of the NFL maybe?
Yeah, probably.
Five a year with what? Do that same schedule. You work 20 weeks of the year.
You think he'd work 20 weeks a year though?
Phil I don't know likes if he his would. Money. You think Phil isn't going out on the PGA Tour playing these guys in money games, fighting for strokes on Wednesday, somehow gets to go play in practice rounds? He's going to, like, I
just don't see Phil hanging out at the production meetings, that's for sure.
No, absolutely not. Take a lap. Like, I what are you going to tell me that you come to my production meeting, but I was joking with a buddy. He was trying to play some bets this weekend, and he was like, do I take Phil in the three ball on Thursday? And I actually responded, do not take Phil. He's a mascot at this point. Yeah, and it just kind of slipped out. I was like, damn, I'm good, because he is at this point become a little bit mascot. When you go out and shoot 77, 80, and you finish your 18th hole on your second day with a 9 on the par 5 at Pebble Beach, things aren't looking good. And it's really upsetting. Why I leave it as a par is because of that, is that about a year ago, I sat on this podcast and I said, Phil's going to be the oldest major winner of all time, and I believe he can pick up a win in his 50s. A year from now, that looks way, way wrong. Like, that is a cold take. I still believe if he has a chance, it will be at Augusta. It's got to be the perfect conditions. And I wouldn't be surprised if he does contend at some point. But right now, Phil just, I'm even nervous what he's going to look like when he goes out on the Champions Tour. This guy can't.
Well, he's won two events already on the Champions Tour for sure. But I mean, I think you're right though, when you made the comment of, you know, I can see this guy contending. There's a big difference between contending and winning.
Especially when you're 50, your nerves can take over easier, right? Like I'm sure there's a psychological, you know, that somebody that smart could get into. Maybe we'll get a doctor on here at one point. Like there is.
I was waiting to hear your dissertation.
Yeah, thanks for helping me out. Just left me. It was like the Zoom froze.
Well, hey, if you're gonna flog 50-year-olds, I've got to defend my age group, right?
You know? I guess, but like it's not good right now. I think that's fair to say. I think it's bad for golf when Phil leaves, but I think it would be great for the broadcast to have Phil on as a broadcaster. At least get him involved. He's never going to disappear. You know what's going to happen. He's eventually going to be that person, and it's going to be the weirdest day ever. And when him and Tiger are going to be hitting those opening tee shots at Augusta. And that, like, it's going to happen. And we're not far. Sure. We're 20 years away from that, probably.
Maybe even less. You never know.
Yeah. I mean, you can't. Can you have a honorary starter hitting it in their 60s? That seems young.
Maybe.
There's guys that have played the Masters still. So I see Phil rocking, playing in the Masters late, being one of those guys. So I don't know about that. But, yeah, I don't know. It's a par for me because it's like we don't know where this is going. What's your bogey for the week?
Bogey for the week for me, that's an easy one. Nate Lashley, you know, obviously talented player, had the lead there at Pebble Beach, made a big faux pas in the fact that, you know, he had a four putt late, cost him a lot of money. I get that. You're going to be frustrated. Smashed the green. Again, frustrated. Pro golfer, whatever the case may be. The bogey for me was looking back. He knew he had damaged the green, and you can clearly see it on television. And, you know, some people tried to argue, oh, it's a flat on the bottom of the putter. Look, I basically did a screen cap and you can see the mark that he made. He did not go back and fix that. And now people did argue and say, oh, well, he was in the last group. Okay. This is not about the last group. This is not about the other players. This is disrespecting the golf course as far as the people that work hard to take care of these golf courses. And the thing is that, you know, it just looks like privilege more than anything of not being willing to go back. I don't care how frustrated you are, you know, and I don't care as well that maybe he says to his caddy, hey, could you go fix that? That's part of it, maybe part of his job. But if you go back and look at it and hesitate, that makes it even worse.
Yeah.
And then didn't do it. And I just felt really bad. And maybe that's me in, you know, having worked on golf courses, that it always drove me nuts that, you know, you would put in all the work, you would do the extra things to take care of that golf course and to make it as great as possible for the people that are going to play it that day. And then next thing you know, they're taking a wedge and taking a chunk out of the green and doing those things. But yeah, for me, that was at least a bogey.
Yeah, he got my honorable mention for the week, and it was going to be a double for that situation. Mm-hmm. And not only for that, I think it happens. I think there's certain players that can get away with it. Nate Lashley is not a tour vet. This guy grinded out for years before finally getting on the PGA Tour in 2018. This guy has one career win with about six top tens in his career. Cool. Like, guys would sign off on that career now. Absolutely. This a win, six top tens, you're out on the tour for a long time. You know, he's probably gonna be out for the next couple of years playing well, awesome. But you know, you don't have that. You don't have the ability to do that and get away with it with that as your career. I was so confused. It did take me a few seconds to be like, wait, why isn't he going back? It did seem like he went to go. He hesitated. He's like, I don't need to go back because somebody else is gonna fix it tomorrow. I'm in the last group. Yeah. Who cares? I mean, I believe there's probably sponsors that have guys that are going out tomorrow to play with the championship tees and the championship pins that paid a boatload of money to do that. And it was a joke. And just quickly, I'm going to set you an over-under here. Nate Lashley is listed at 6'1", 190 pounds.
190? Shut up.
So I guess you're taking me over. Yeah, I just saw 190.
He's 190, I'm 190.
Yeah, 190. I was like, no. No. I don't think so. Did go to the University of Arizona. I'll give him a pass for that.
You know, here's the thing. Nothing that he does really excuses it. And again, you know what? You're a professional golfer. I get it. You're frustrated. Hey, we've all been mad at some point or whatever. But, you know, you made your mistake. Just fix it. That's it. Yeah. Just fix it. If he'd gone back and fixed it, fine, whatever. I wouldn't think anything of it.
Dweeb move, 100%. I'm going to give my bogey. I already gave my honorable mention. Was his breakdown. That four putt easily cost him $300,000. Probably another $50,000 for that that punch to the middle of the green there. My bogey for the week, though, is Daniel Berger's putting routine. So when they made
not quick enough for you?
It's awful. That was the worst final group pairing of all time. Patrick Cantlay and Daniel Berger together. I'm trying to think if there's a third guy that maybe throw Kevin Na. I know we
JB Holmes if he was around.
JB Holmes. Throw JB. I like Kevin. Those two together, just awful. Like, what is Patrick? He just stands over the ball forever. And just cut away. Just cut away. But no, they're in. They nothing they like more than watching Patrick.
Well, they don't know when he's going to hit it because he doesn't move.
Who cares? Show it in 2 minutes. Like, oh, and he just hit. He finally hit the ball. Make a joke about it. But the putting routine from Daniel Berger, when they eliminated caddies lining up their player, was to speed up play.
Yeah.
This has now slowed down play because what he does is the caddy lines up the play, lines him up. They stand over there. He then steps away, picks up his ball marker, gets back into position, and then makes the putt. And it's so slow. I hate it. I love everything else about Daniel Berger and the fact that he owns his swing. His swing is his. Nobody's teaching that left-hand grip with that right-hand grip and the layoff and the hip movement. Very self-taught player, obviously, as a coach, but it's a very feel game to make it work. And this guy plays his game, but that's got to go. It's got to go.
Yeah, what he reminds me of is the guy at the golf course who creates a putting routine, has success one day, then adds another piece to it, makes a couple of putts, adds another piece to it, and before you know it, you know, everything is like, wow, this is like a five-act play here just to go through and hit one putt, even when he's like trying to make a two-footer.
Yeah, my buddy's mom used to so she used to lay her – she did a drill one time with a coach. So they're teaching – and she's not playing for any money, so do whatever you want. But they – like the drill, the coach was trying to get her to understand aim. So he put down like a club as the stick. So that's your aim.
Yeah.
You know, line up and hit it there. So what they did was she brought it to the golf course. She put the club down. She'd set up her feet in line with the club, pick up the club, and then hit it. And that's kind of what it reminded me of. It's like, that is so slow. Please stop doing this. Please stop doing this. And hey, whatever, if it makes you play better. But yeah, huge bogey. It's awful. Yeah, like, you're on the PGA Tour. It's amateur hour. I'm over it. I hate it. I hate it. What's your honorable mention for the week?
Yeah, honorable mention for me is Korn Ferry Tour is back this week. And Alvin Choi, who we've talked about a fair bit on this show, who obviously was caddying for Sungjae Im, he Monday qualified. So he's going to be playing in the League Cup Suncoast Classic. And even on his own Instagram, he just said, you know what? It's good to be back.
Yeah.
So nice to see Alvin back out there. He's had quite a journey in his life. Hell of a player. Good to see. And hopefully he sticks this week. Hopefully he plays well and works his way into some more events.
Yeah, Pendrith was saying that they played together the week before and he shot like 9 under with like 3 bogeys or something like that.
It's
insane. And I believe his quote to Bob Weeks was, you know, he's back. Like the Albin's back. He's that guy though for Canada where, you know, he was the Tiger Woods of Canada in the eyes of like him as a kid, right? Like the highest of high standards. I remember they have TSN stories about this kid all the time through college and everyone thought he's, you know, going to be the next greatest thing. And unfortunately, just didn't live up to that. And his biggest paycheck to date would be winning as a caddy. And probably is funding this next year because, you know, he was working as a club caddy prior to that. Great guy. Tough life prior to this, you know, especially right before going to college, you know, his mom committing suicide and all of that stuff. If you haven't found this kid's story, you need to go find it. Awesome dude, though. I don't know anyone that's met him that says a bad thing about the kid. So look for that. And I was talking to Pendrith a little bit. Sounds like he will be playing at Puerto Rico. So it looks like he's getting a PGA Tour start, and we should have him on the podcast next couple of weeks after he plays in that. So looking forward to that. That's a great honorable mention for the Canadians. We also have a Canadian on this podcast, Scotty. I wasn't on this interview. You ended up sitting down with Christine Fraser. What were you chatting with Christine about?
Yeah, Christine Fraser, who's a golf architect, originally from this area, not far from here, but she's made a career for herself. Not only was she an NCAA golfer, but she went on to get her master's in landscape architecture, worked for Martin Hawtrey over in England, doing a lot of work now with Jeff Mingay, getting ready to go back to England at some point as well, but has a great perspective on the game, a different perspective than maybe some people have. And, you know, she talked a lot about that, what, you know, went into her career, what her thoughts are on the game and especially the future of the game and how golf course design can influence that. So I think people enjoy listening to Christine Fraser, one of the best young people in the game and a voice that people will be listening to for quite some time. We want to welcome to the podcast a longtime friend, and I think somebody who's got a perspective on the game that a lot of people will be very interested to hear about. We're talking a lot in golf these days about the future of the game. And, you know, if we're going to shape the future of the game, we need perspectives of people who know a lot about the game and have a different look at the game. And Christine Fraser is somebody who I think has a great perspective on the game. And I think all our listeners will enjoy that as well. So Christine Fraser, golf architect of Christine Fraser Design, welcome to the show.
Hi, Scott. Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be catching up after so long.
Yeah, it's been a while. We've known each other for quite some time. And, you know, you grew up near where I live as well in the Kingston area. Why don't we talk a little bit first about, you know, influences for you as far as where you got the love of the game first?
Well, that's a very easy answer for me, and it comes from my mother and her family business, which is a public golf course just outside of Kingston, and spent a lot of summers and a lot of time at the golf course, and that's where I was introduced to the game of golf, and it really kind of, during those formative childhood years, it just really started off my golf interest.
Now, what was it that appealed to you? Obviously, you're in a position where it is your family, you know, your grandparents founded the golf course and, you know, your family is influenced by it. But, you know, you were there, you were put in that situation, but, you know, you could have chose to do something else. What was it about the game that appealed to you?
Yeah. And to be frank, I wasn't entirely drawn to golf right away in the beginning, at least the game of golf. I was more drawn to the environment, the people that were there, the sort of the privilege of being able to spend every summer on a golf course. The game of golf wasn't that interesting to me in the beginning.
Yeah.
I think it was just the environment that was in. It was a really safe, comfortable environment for me. It taught me a lot of those lessons that you need as a child. I got to spend so much time with my brother and my mom outside. So I think that's what really draw me into the game of golf in the beginning.
Do you think that's part of the appeal for a lot of people as well? I mean, you know, everybody always talks about things like scorecards and things like that. But, you know, do you think that environment, be it in a public environment, private environment, whatever the case may be, but, you know, just the things that golf provides, do you think that appeals to a lot of other people the same way?
I think this year in particular really showed us the potential that golf has in that sense of just being a really important or accessible part of how we spend our time and where we want to put our money and being outside and being with the people that we want to be with. Golf can provide that for us. So, yeah, I do. I think it's a big draw.
And for you, I mean, you say that about that environment, but what did you see in a golf course when you were growing up? I mean, we all, you know, if we grow up in the game, you know, we play the sport, we go out, you know, maybe we're hitting the shots, but a lot of time we're looking around, we're seeing things. What was it for you? What did you vision, you know, what did you have a vision of as far as when you saw the golf course itself?
Well, this might be a little bit straying from your question, but I didn't really see the golf course in terms of the exterior so much as I saw the behind the scenes of what went into maintaining a golf course. And I was really kind of curious about what's underneath and the layers that it has. And it's actually so complex and so interesting. And there's so many different elements to a golf course, from, you know, soil to turf to drainage to, you know, the types of grasses and how they grow and how water features can engage and interact with all of those things. That's what really what interested me.
How long did it take you before you began to say, you know, to your grandfather going, what made you do this? And, you know, what did it take to put this together? Because again, you know, this was a family project. Their whole family was involved in building this golf course. And, you know, that's not a decision someone just makes lightly.
No. And Unfortunately, I didn't get to ask him that before he passed away, but I think from photographs I've seen and stories that my grandmother and my mother have recounted, it's an absolute miracle that from what I've learned over the past 5 years of what it takes to build a golf course and maintain a golf course, let alone the operational side of it, is so complex. It's so incredible to me that it's still in operation. Yeah. And that my grandfather, with absolutely no experience in golf course design, was able to first of all route something, yeah, and then make it functional and make it, you know, to the extent of the success that it has today. It's amazing. Yeah.
We should mention it's the Camden Braes Golf and Country Club in Odessa, Ontario. So, you know, we've got to give it that plug that
way.
Before we sort of go full circle and maybe go back and talk about some things that you were able to do at the golf course, which is kind of neat when you begin to think about it, let's at least give people a little bit more of how your perspective was enhanced in golf, in the fact that not only were you a fine player, that you ended up playing NCAA golf as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I ended up being quite good at golf without having to try too hard, because I was
You are modest, because you are a great athlete. So.
I was interested in other things, and golf just kind of fell into my lap of like this amazing opportunity to get me into university and get me to be able to travel and see different types of golf courses and pay for some of my tuition. So it really afforded me that experience that I wouldn't have had otherwise. And going to school in Florida was pretty incredible. Culture shock a little bit at first, but It was amazing.
And how did your vision change about the game when you were at Stetson? Because again, as you said, you were able to go out and play some great golf courses. You're exposed to, you know, facilities that you didn't see back home in Canada. What was changing for you in your perspective of the game at that time?
The very basics of it was I had never seen Bermuda grass before. So that was a whole, I mean, in terms of technique of playing the game, that was a whole new experience of learning how to hit out of the rough. So I was caught a little bit behind in the beginning. And also, we can mention that Camden Braes has no bunkers. So
yes.
Also a little bit of behind the curve in that sense. And Florida golf in particular is very keen on bunkers. Bunkering.
Lots of bunkers, lots of water.
So I took those 4 years to really kind of concentrate on my playing abilities and my technique and my skill of from the player and the competitive side. So the architecture interest never went away, but it wasn't really the focus. And then it became the focus after I graduated and kind of realized that I wasn't good enough to continue playing golf at any kind of professional level to have a career of it. And it also didn't really interest me.
Yeah.
Playing golf in Florida for 4 years, 6 days a week is quite a lot all year round. We're two semester sports. So yeah, it was a lot. The architecture interest kicked off sort of post undergraduate.
So then you made that decision to, you know, to go to Guelph and start pursuing that. At this point, were you beginning to study sort of, you know, architects and some of their works around the world? What was your interest level kind of at that point, and how did it grow?
Yeah. And at that point, I was kind of put down the Golf Channel and picked up, you know, the golf course architecture magazines and really got into learning about what the potential was going forward in terms of having a career in golf course architecture. And there's not really one sort of specific way to get there. It's so different for everybody. And they no longer have the formal university program in Edinburgh. But for me, it was trying to figure out the path I wanted to take to get there, whether it was through construction or through getting my master's degree, which is what I ended up going with.
Yeah, and I can remember, you know, that time. I was fortunate, obviously, to get to have a look at your thesis at that time, which was exciting for me to be able to read that and see your perspectives on the game. Mm-hmm. You were able, through the Stanley Thompson Society, to make a foray to study the game a little bit more and the golf courses of the world by going over to the UK. Mm-hmm. That obviously had a major influence in your life as far as seeing what was out there, you know, hundreds of years before. Tell us a little bit about that and how important that was as far as influencing what you do today?
Yeah, that was a huge pivoting point in my trajectory. And I was able to go over to Scotland because I was given a grant from the Stanley Thompson Society. So I went over there to do data collection, and I just played golf and called it scholarly. Through some of the connections that I made over there, I was able to go to some of the most historic golf courses in the world, including, you know, Royal Dornoch was the first links golf course I had ever played.
Oh my, you're spoiled.
So, you know, it's pretty much only downhill from there. And I saw North Berwick, and I had never seen anything like North Berwick before. Yeah. I mean, there's a stone wall that runs right through the fairway.
It does.
And then St. Andrews. And then finally I went to the new hot course at the time, which was Trumbaberdeen. And that's how I met Martin. So that was a really important trip for me. And I also got my first tattoo there. So
that's an important thing as well.
Yeah.
What was it you saw in features? I mean, North Berwick is a great example. I mean, it's a quirky golf course. It obviously serves as a qualifier for things like the, you know, the British Amateur and so forth. But it's not a design that, you know, would host a championship event, you know, in current times. And as I said, it has its quirks about it as far as, but it's one of the most copied designs as far as some of the particular features around the world. Mm-hmm. How did that start to open up your brain as far as the possibilities of what could happen out in golf?
Yeah, I think as I had experienced going to Florida and having to kind of relearn some techniques of how to play at a Bermuda grass, I had that same experience going to Scotland of like, okay, well, there's actually 17 different ways I can get to the green from here. And it was that sort of strategic thinking that I hadn't really fully engaged with before, and that piqued my interest as an architect. It just kind of ignited some creativity. It really added value to the round for me. So exploring the ground game and the scale of the golf courses was really important during that trip.
Did you begin to see sort of, you know, that these golf courses maybe presented multiple ways to play them for different levels of golfers? Because obviously, as we talk about, you know, Florida, much of the architecture in Florida is sort of forced. You know, there's one way to go at some of the facilities, but that's not what you see when you go over and see the links courses.
Yeah, it's not. And it's more of a strategic design strategy rather than a penal. And that just inherently allows for people of all types of skill levels to make their way to the green in an interesting way that suits their game.
So then, you know, you connect with Martin Hawtrey, I should mention, obviously revered, done a lot of great projects around the world, involved with amazing. The list is endless. People can certainly look that up. Mm-hmm. You know, was the consultant for the RNA as well. What impact did that have? Because obviously for Martin in doing it, and you know, not knowing Martin, but knowing his work fairly extensively, while he's working on championship golf courses and, you know, things people revere as far as being, you know, difficult and so forth, that's not really what he's all about when he's designing golf courses, correct?
Yeah. And he really taught me how to appreciate the details of the work that he was doing. And, you know, you get all of these big names that are very overwhelming and pretty important, but it, when you're in it, and especially with Martin, it's more just about the basics. And so he really taught me how to engage in the scale of the architecture and the specific details of, say, the green surrounds, and also to really consider the strategy in holes too. So he's more of it really taught me the finer details in architecture.
And do you think your playing background kind of helped you look at that as well? Because I mean, you know, not every architect is a, you know, a fine player, and being a good player as you were, and also having the experience of growing up in a public course where you saw lots of different, you know, levels of players, you know, how did you sort of apply that knowledge to what you were seeing in the golf courses?
I think being a player certainly helped me understand the functionality of a hole, but I tried not to let my own experience have too much influence. I don't think I'm that important, really.
Sure, but I mean, obviously, what you've done in the game and how you recognize playing holes is, you know, that's important when you're looking at the perspective of a good player playing those courses.
Yeah, I think that's true. But one of my favorite things to do is play from the most forward tees when I go to new courses, just to see how much they care about those people. And
that's interesting.
So I think I was more concerned about using my perspective as a woman and my perspective as, you know, an older golfer 50 years from now.
Yeah.
That was more of the forefront of what I was interested in.
No, you know, you played some of those great links golf courses, and obviously you start with something like Royal Darnock, but did you get in a lot of chances to play, like, you know, if you're in St. Andrews, did you play like the Balgov course instead of playing just the old course, or, you know, something like that? That's a, you know, shorter design for a variety of players. Did you experience some of those courses in Scotland as well?
I didn't actually bring my clubs over for a couple of years.
Wow.
So I was really focused on the architecture, and
yeah.
I personally find it very difficult to play golf and take in the architecture at the same time.
Right.
So for me, it was a lot of just walking the course. That was the way that I best understood the architecture. So this is so awful and I'm going to regret it. This is going to be my only regret. I know.
Okay.
I mean, I've never played the old course. I've never played any golf in St. Andrews.
Yeah.
So,
but you walked the property.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think people don't appreciate that you learn a lot more about that piece of property probably by walking it. And I can say that, you know, in 2014, I was there in the summertime and I didn't play the old that whole week. I stayed six days in St. Andrews at that time and I walked it every night. I would walk that property. And I played the new a fair bit when I was there. I played Balgov. I played Eden. But walking that property, you'll learn so much more about it than, you know, just with a golf club in your hand going on one path.
I agree.
Yeah. Okay. You know, that played into a lot of things, you know, in talking about, you know, sustainable golf. You know, you're talking here about what your game is going to look like in 50 years, which is obviously very important because, you know, when we look at a game, it's very historic. It's been around a lot of time, but we're probably at a more critical time in talking about sustainability because we have a lot of we have a lot of financial influences in the game now that really impact things that maybe, you know, steer it away from sustainability. A great example would be probably, you know, the era in the 1990s where all of a sudden everybody was trying to build, you know, 7,000 yard championship golf courses and ignoring the fact that, you know, we needed feeder facilities to kind of grow the game and sustain the game long term. I know when we go to your website and you've got ChristineFraserDesign.com now where people go, one of the key aspects that I see in there is your social impact offerings. And I love that. There's really some cool things in there. Explain to us a little bit of what that is, why you feel it's a priority for what you do and what everybody does as far as the game is concerned.
Yeah. And I think maybe just to clarify, sustainability on one side is certainly the environmental aspect of it.
Of course.
And-
yeah.
And how our climates are changing so rapidly and how golf is going to deal with that. But on the other side, sustainability in terms of are people going to want to play golf in 30 years and who are they and what do they look like? And I think, you know, I saw a photo actually on Twitter, my new favorite medium, of Formby Golf Club in the UK. They posted a photo from 135 years ago of their membership standing outside the clubhouse. And they posted a recent photo this year. And it literally looks the exact same. I mean, it's the same people in both photos. They're all, you know, old white men.
Yeah.
And that look isn't sustainable in my eyes. And I think in order for golf to be something that is valued and important going forward, we need to address the accessibility issues and the diversity issues. And I don't see a lot of people doing that in terms of architects.
How can an architect influence that? Like what's your perspective on that, of what they can do to attract people to the game and keep them involved in the game?
I mean, very basically is just consideration of the other, and allowing these different perspectives to influence your decisions. And people in sort of management practices and operationally have ample opportunity to consider, you know, people who potentially have disability issues. How can they access the golf course? Do they have the right facilities that will make them feel welcome and considered during their experience? So there are questions we can ask to just make it more inclusive. And I think we need to do that.
So, I mean, if you're going to the average golf course for you, I mean, you know, are you going through a checklist a lot of times when you go to a golf club and sort of see what they do and how they go about it?
Yeah. And I think I often don't need to look for it. It's often, it's right on the scorecard. Are they calling the forward tees the ladies tees? Or is the starter, you know, informing me how to use the gas and the brake on the golf cart and not my male playing partners? It's often very obvious. Is there a washroom on the golf course for me to use halfway through? And if there's not, is there someone in the pro shop telling me that it's closed because there's a pandemic? So there are thoughts that we can have to make the experience better for a lot of different people.
Do you think the problem in a lot of cases is that maybe people make a lot of assumptions early? I mean, we see that even when people go as a guest, be it male, female, whatever the case may be, when you go to a golf club and there's a lack of signage, you know, and people get there and they get anxious and they get confused and they're like, this is not a great experience.
Possibly. I think initially it wasn't even a matter of consideration. It's, you know, this is for us and by us. So no one else really, really matters. And it's kind of progressed from there. It's this sort of secular kind of experience of, well, we built this for us and now we're in charge. So we make the decisions and there's no need to change because we quite enjoy it.
Yeah.
And that leads into, you know, reduce participation rates, or at least not tapping into the people that who could potentially help, you know, take golf into the next chapter.
So, I mean, a lot of the issues, and I mean, I think a lot of people recognize that, is that, you know, getting more people in the game is not a matter of just making it, fantastic. It means making that accessible, and that means different types of facilities as well. And you've been involved with some. Adlington Golf Center, I know, is one, and you mentioned Twitter, and I saw you post a picture of it the other day, and I was curious right away, recognized that, you know, you had some involvement in that. And, you know, one, can you explain a little bit about what it is? I know what it is because I looked it up, but I want to hear it from your perspective of what it is and why it's important, especially in that corridor of Liverpool, Manchester, and England, where, you know, there's some fantastic golf courses, but there's some golf courses that I would call scary. If you're an average player, you would be more than, you know, you'd be so intimidated probably to play those golf courses that you might quit after playing the game for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, places like that you mentioned, I won't say any names, but they make sure it's entirely terrifying when you step on the property. So people and places like Adlington Golf Center are so valuable to the community because they are just so welcoming, so accessible, so affordable for most people. And I mean, if you look at the website, it says, like, you turn up in your jeans, let's have some fun.
Yeah.
Let's hit some balls after work. There's no pretense. There's no assumption that you know anything about golf, and that doesn't matter. And they've really created the facilities that promote that type of kind of carefree, enjoyable atmosphere. They spent a lot of money on the golf course, and they made some fantastic decisions that, you know, probably don't cost as much money, but are certainly more sustainable in the long run. For example, they don't have any bunkers on the nine that we just built. And that not only reduces their maintenance budget by a grand amount, it also enables people who are beginning or learning to get around the golf course with a certain level of enjoyment and rather than frustration. And that's not to say that type of architecture is boring or not challenging for the better player, because I think you can make it, the green surrounds really interesting with big, broad movements and shortcut grass that's really, really tricky to chip off of.
Yeah, and then we should mention, you know, it's the course that, you know, you managed to be part of there, it's 660 yards. You know, the longest hole is the first hole, and it's a massive, what, 86 yards or 88 yards? 88 yards.
No, that's actually, I think you're looking at the Academy.
Oh, okay. All right.
It's the graduate. So, but the longest hole is just over 200 yards.
Okay. So, I mean, but again, you know, it's achievable for most players, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, do you want to see more? I mean, I think that's an obvious question, but, or an obvious answer, but, you know, do you want to see more of those type of facilities in North America? And do you think that will be essential to the future of the game here?
I do think it's absolutely imperative that we start to look at these different types of community center type facilities. And I think the experience that I've had in the past and the reception to those type of ideas is really positive. And it's a way that golf can keep growing. And in that sense, I'm very optimistic about the future of golf because I think we have such an untapped market still of people who want to get involved. So, yeah. And I think especially with what the RNA is doing in Glasgow, it feels really positive and exciting.
We should talk about that project a little bit. I mean, you know, the RNA announced that the other day and, you know, they're rehabbing basically a small facility that's in Glasgow and not the greatest area of town, you know, based on talking to a few people from that area. But, you know, they're going to put the effort into something that's a project that, as you said, it's going to be a community center. And it's not just about golf, but it is an incubator for a lot of positive things in their community and can make a difference in that community. How do you think that will set an example, not only for governing bodies, but maybe as well for corporate interests to see that, you know, there's a way that they can influence people and, you know, do something good in a community. And really, it's not cost prohibitive compared to what they maybe spend on some other things that they do.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're, what are they spending? 17 million Canadian dollars.
Yeah.
On this project, and it's really extensive. They're going to have gym facilities, cafes, and I think that's probably going to be one of the attractions of the project, that it's not just golf. It's all of these things, and it's a more kind of widespread interest for the entire family, and I think that's really powerful. Golf's great, but it's, you know, for me, it's not the only thing. And I'm attracted to places that have some other offerings as well, whether that be, you know, great food or great social environment or, you know, great gym facilities. Let's do something different like that. Yeah.
Do you think that means, you know, for people, it's attracting them to spend more time there, not just more golf time, like families and social experiences? And are there specific examples besides that that maybe that you've seen that you thought, oh, that's really cool. That's something that, you know, could really be applicable someplace else.
Yeah. Jeff Mingay, my colleague, and I had the opportunity to look at a potential site north of Toronto. And some of their ideas were really exciting. They wanted to have, you know, kind of a date night environment where you can play golf or you can do a wine tasting or you can listen to the band. And there's, you know, art installations on the fairways. And so I think it's really important to be thinking not just golf. And I think there's a lot of value in that.
And for you, I mean, personally, does that give you more satisfaction to look forward to that type of project? Or, you know, obviously there's satisfaction in working with, you know, some amazing world-class golf course. You know, we'll put that in air quotes. What appeals to you more?
Yeah, I think what I got out of Martin Hawtrey, that experience was just, you know, learning how to design great golf courses. But, I mean, there are 10 other fantastic architects that already have the established career and the repertoire that you can, you know, you can call if you want to build a Trump Aberdeen again.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's necessarily me. Great. I mean, sure. Please give me a new build somewhere.
you'll take the gig. Sure.
I'll take the gig, but I think I have, something different to offer, and that probably doesn't come with the new builds in that scale of, you know, championship golf courses.
No, it's not to me. I don't even think of it different. I see you as a golf architect and that's it. But, you know, you're in a unique position that you happen to be a woman in the world of golf architecture, whereas people are maybe not familiar with the influences that some of the women have had in golf. I mean, obviously, a lot of people talk about Pete Dye, but, you know, they don't understand and appreciate what Alice Dye did as far as, you know, the facilities he was involved in. What does that mean to you to kind of be, you know, I won't call it alone, but lonely as far as the number of women that maybe are part of that, you know, career path for you?
Yeah, it can be quite isolating and intimidating and maybe not always so welcomed into the industry, but it also feels good to be in a position where I have some kind of small platform and people like you are able to bring me on and let me speak. And there are great programs happening, you know, women in turf are gathering together and creating this huge wave, and it's really exciting. So there's two sides to this. And, you know, women have always been involved in golf and even golf architecture. They're there. We're there. We just, we don't get the books written about us as much. So I think it's important to consider women in the industry in any capacity, broadcasters, journalists, architects, superintendents. Like, let's elevate these people. Let's give them the accessibility and inclusion, and golf will be better for it.
Yeah, 100%. I totally agree with it. One last note, and I kind of want to ask you this question, but, you know, what makes a golf project more of everything for everyone? I know that's a convoluted question, but, you know, overall, what encapsulates the game for you and what it can be for everyone?
You go first.
Well, that's a good thing. I think it reflects exactly what you're talking about. I mean, I think it has to become integral to their life and not something that's isolated as far as it's golf, it's hockey, it's this sport or whatever. I think, you know, if people went to a place like St. Andrews and realized that golf is just what you do. And I always go back to a great example of, you know, being there in town and going over, and, you know, my wife and daughter didn't want to play golf that day. They're going to do some other things. And I went over to the Bow Golf course, and I ended up playing with a 12-year-old that lived in the village, and we played 54 holes that day.
Oh my God, amazing.
With all his buddies, all their friends. And I joke that I saw more 16-year-old girls with perfect golf swings that day than I've ever seen in my life. And knowing the fact that, you know what, they... for anybody who lives in the village until they're the age of 16, they get to play the Lynx Trust courses for free. And as a result, they don't think of it as anything different. It's just part of their life. And then later on, they might go away from the game after they're 16, but they'll always have been introduced to the game. So they don't think of it as a barrier when somebody, when they're 25 years old, says, hey, let's go play golf. Okay, sure, fine, let's go do that. They don't go, oh, that's scary.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of comfort around.
Yeah, and I think that's a little bit of what you even talk about for the intimidation factor and all the things that we see at golf courses. And, you know, I talked about on this podcast, you know, a while back that I had a lady come to me who was, you know, high up in the World Bank. She did a lot of training for, and, you know, just a high-level person from a corporate perspective. And she came to do golf lessons, and she didn't really want to know about technique. She wanted to know about, where do I go? Where do I stand? What do I do? And the thing is, I asked her about that, and she said, well, I don't want to feel uncomfortable. I want to feel comfortable when I go to the place so that I don't feel nervous and scared. Mm-hmm. And then as a result of it, then she feels like she fits in. So right. I think that's part of it, of making it part of your life and not just isolated as far as a sport.
Yes, well done.
So I get up. To answer my own question. I love that. well, that's awesome. I really appreciate it coming on. I mean, I think it's very important as far as the voice that you have in the game. And, you know, I've respected and admired you for quite some time. And, you know, whether it be on the golf course and what you've done in your career and you know, reading your master's and the ability that you have to see the game in a different way. And I think that's going to have a big influence And I look forward to following your career more and seeing more of what you do in the game.
Well, thanks for your curiosity, Scott. Appreciate it.
No worries.
Thank you, Christine, for that interview. Appreciate your insight. It's just nice. I think one of the coolest parts is it's not woman designer. It's mm-hmm. a great designer that happens to be a woman. I think I just like the wording of that. I thought you handled that interview great. So thanks, Christine, for the time and nice to see. Yeah, I think she's local. I think she we can take her as our own.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, she used to work for our friends at Accra at one point, and I played some golf with her when she was working with them. And, you know, as we talked about in the interview, her grandparents started Camden Braes mm-hmm. Golf and Country Club, not far from here. And, you know, as she said, it had a big influence on her game. So it's just odd, I guess, when you have somebody that's that local, as we say, but has now done stuff on a worldwide stage and just happens to be from here, just like she just happens to be a woman.
Exactly. It's a cool story. Look forward to watching the rest of that and seeing her change some golf courses in this area eventually around. That'll be cool when, you know, years from now, it's almost like the Christine Fraser design versus the Stanley Thompson design, like every golf course in Canada. Go. Who knows? maybe we're putting her too high on a pedestal, really having to live up to that. PGA Tour is back this week. Korn Ferry Tour is back this week. Scotty, what's the hardest part about recording the second half of this podcast for you?
Why?
For me, it's the struggle of I've finished that first beer, and it's a weeknight, and it's like
you want another.
You want another, right? And it's do you do that? Because you know, I don't know about you. The second one is the one where
is that your tipping point?
Yeah, it's like, do you keep going, right? And it's a weeknight. The Leafs are on tonight. First place in the NHL, not a big deal. Going to regret that wording on
enjoy,
here.
Enjoy it while you can, yeah.
Yeah, so tonight, apparently people like when we talk about what we're drinking on the podcast. So I'm going to give a shout-out to the Market Brewing Company.
Never heard of it. Where are they?
The Market Brewing Company is out in Newmarket. You can find them on Leslie Street. This is a nice Metropolitan Porter. Pretty nice. Little cool. Hints of chocolate in there. Yeah, pretty solid.
I was talking to our boy Jeff Tate from Triple Bogey Golf just a little while ago, so he's going to crawl on here at some point. We'll have a good chat with him.
That'd be a good sponsor for the pod.
Yeah, for sure.
Hey, what are you drinking? Same as always.
Exactly. So, yeah, we're not bringing Jeff on just to squeeze him to be a sponsor, although, yeah.
But we might.
We might, but yeah, he's got a cool story. So at some point he'll jump on there too. I think that's the other hard part is balancing. You know, we were 102 episodes into this, created a list early on as far as, you know, who would come on as guests. That list gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So it's hard. I mean, I end up talking to somebody today who, you know, I've been talking to for about, you know, a year and a half of having them on the podcast, but it just seems we keep running into guests and more guests and more guests. So that's a good thing. We have lots to look forward to.
Open invite for Jeff. Maybe we'll do a tasting test while he's on the podcast. That'd be riveting for radio. Yeah, well,
he's got some cool stuff. They got a seltzer going now. They've got wine in a can that they did before. They got all sorts of different things. And Jeff's an interesting cat. He was involved with a couple other golf-related businesses before. So I think people will enjoy his story when he comes on.
Let's do it. What are you drinking during this episode?
Just a little quick ginger and Irish whiskey, a little Bushmills.
Bushmills. All right. Okay. Yeah. I like it.
Nothing crazy. Just a subtle little...
Just a subtle little whiskey at 4 o'clock. You know. I like it. 25th anniversary of Happy Gilmore.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Couple
great video content. He came out with the video of him saying, I haven't done this in 25 years, him trying the Happy Gilmore swing. Yeah. And then Shooter came out with a great video as well. His response to it. I thought that was great. I need to plan for this weekend is to throw on Happy Gilmore at some point. I think it's only due. But my understanding is you came up with a little bit of a game.
Yeah, I was trying to come up with some ideas for some things to do this week or whatever. And I thought, you know what, 25th anniversary, let's come up with some Happy Gilmore trivia. But the hard part is like, let's just not get all the obvious stuff. There's a couple things in there that are maybe a little bit more obvious, but I came up with five questions that I'll challenge you with, and you might get, you might not, but in the meantime, people may learn a little something about Happy Gilmore. How's that?
All right, let's hit it.
All right, here we go. What was the budget for the movie? And this one is multiple choice. $5 million, $10 million, $17 million, or $22 million. Obviously, wow, not a lot compared to blockbusters these days.
No, but, I mean, hindsight, like, what's that in dollars today and everything along those lines? True. That's crazy. If you just made me guess it, I would have guessed low, right? There's not a much going on there.
No. And it was 1996. February 16th, 96 this came out.
Yeah. I'm going actually, with the five. Was it five?
Five, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to go $5 million. It's not a lot, I don't think, for the golf movie.
Yeah, close. $10 million. Obviously, they filmed a lot of it in
Canada.
Close,
double.
Well, you know, relative. It's not like...
It was B.
Yeah, it was B. $10 million. So, not a lot. Obviously, you know, Gilmore did the writing with another buddy of his. Gilmore. Adam Sandler did it with a buddy of his or whatever. And, you know... it was a flyer. It really was. I mean, a gamble like anything else, but in the end, it sort of worked. Now, how well did it work takes us to question two. Obviously, this has become an iconic movie. A lot of people know it. It's a cultural kind of thing. A lot of people know the quotes and so forth, but how much did it actually do at the box office? And you've got to guess within $5
million. Oh. Budget was 10.
Yep.
Right. Going 18.5.
41.2, which was actually higher than I thought it would be.
Wow. That's, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean Bob Barker. Bob Barker, maybe. Maybe he was pitching that. Maybe at the end of Price is Right, he was saying, like, you know, spay and neuter your pets and go see Happy Gilmore.
Happy Gilmore. Well, I'll tell you what. Adam Sandler actually did an appearance on The Price is Right. They did a promo for it. He showed up during the showcase showdown, and they played a clip in the movie. So chances are it probably did something for the movie. On the other side of that as well, after the movie came out, and this is not part of my trivia, the demographic for The Price is Right ended up shooting up in the college age bracket because of the movie. Hard to believe. So
yeah. There we go. Okay. All right. We're learning
number
a lot.
Three. Speaking of Bob Barker, what action star helped Bob Barker train for the fight scene, which originally he was scheduled, they were going to have a double, and he insisted he wanted to do the fight scene and not just a basic, he wanted to do the whole thing.
Do I get any options on that?
No. Just a famous action star. You're probably going to guess it. It's one of his neighbors.
Oh, I got nothing. Jackie Chan?
Chuck Norris.
Chuck Norris? Okay.
Hard to believe.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Is that so part Chuck of the budget? Norris,
and I guess his brother as well. I guess they did some training with Bob over the years on getting ready for that fight scene. So, all right. Number four here. This one's interesting. I did not know this till the other day when he came out and admitted it on Twitter, which, you know, was because it kind of an interesting piece of trivia. But what Canadian golfer who was a PGA Tour member and a winner on tour turned down a role as a consultant and still regrets it?
Okay, repeat that one more time. There's a lot of words in there.
All right. What Canadian golfer who was a PGA Tour member,
okay,
right, turned down the role as the consultant and still regrets it? Now, I would tell you they did have a PGA Tour consultant on the movie. It was Mark Lai, but they offered the role to this guy who was a Canadian, and he turned it down, and he said his kids bug him about it, and he regrets it.
I'm going to go Stephen Ames.
Richard Zokel.
Okay.
Actually, good old BC Rick. Guy.
Yeah. Dick Zokel.
Yep.
All right.
BC guy. And they asked him if he could do consulting on it, and he didn't. So, yeah, Mark Lai was in there, and Lee Trevino, of course, played a scene in there. But Richard Zokel, yeah, got asked to do it. All right. Speaking of people that could appear in this, as I mentioned, you know, Trevino appeared in this movie. There was an NHL Hall of Famer that appeared in this movie. He was an uncredited role in the hockey tryout scene. And he went into the Hall of Fame in 2012 with your boy Matt Sundin. Four people went in that year. I'll give you a clue if you want.
Yeah, give me a clue. Is he a Boston Bruin?
Nope. He retired in 2009 after 21 seasons. That's your first clue, if you want.
Okay.
I can give you another one, but I think that will start to give it away. Because so we knew we went into the Hall of Fame, 2012.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm drawing a blank right now.
Retired in 09, did 21 seasons from 88 to 2009. Did his whole career with the Nordique and the Avalanche. Well, that should
Joe Sakic?
Yeah, Joe Sakic's
in the movie?
Apparently, it's wow. an uncredited role. I'm going to have to go back and look at the scene, but yeah, apparently he is in the movie.
Interesting. Huh. Yeah. So, hey, one for five. Not bad.
There you go. There's your Happy Gilmore 25th anniversary trivia.
All right, we'll go a little further. What's your favorite one-liner from the movie?
Oh man, you know what? That was the other thing that I was doing. I was kind of looking through all the quotes or whatever, and God, there's so many of them. I mean, you go.
I was going to say
there's so many
of them.
That's the thing.
Yeah. I'm actually on this website. It's one of those articles where it's like, you know, rankings of the top quotes, and it may as well say, "You wouldn't believe what's at number three." Mine's.
Oh yeah,
you're in my world now, Grandma.
yeah. You're Stiller. Owning the grandma.
Yeah, Stiller's so good. Now you'll go to sleep, or I'll put you to sleep.
Oh man, there's so many. You're probably on the same site that. Jeez.
Yeah, or, you know, he says, like, if I saw myself in clothes like that, I have to kick my own ass. Like,
no, that was the thing. He was so self-deprecating in this movie, where he just went on about things or whatever. So, I mean, I think Chubbs, It's All in the Hips, was the one that, you know, kind of lasted for a long while or whatever. So, with Carl Weathers or whatever, and it was just kind of awkward. And obviously a lot of people, too, know the, you know, just tap it in, give it a little tap, tap-a-roo, you know. But, there's so many in this one.
Great movie.
It's not Caddyshack, but there's certainly a lot of them that are in there. So.
Yeah, different generation. I think it's a different generation's Caddyshack.
You're right. Yeah.
All right, why don't we grab a quick break? We'll come back with the mailbag, and then we'll wrap up the episode. All right, Scotty, every single week, the mailbag comes out. This week, we tried. I think we're still working on the voice memo stuff. I don't even know if we know how to do a voice memo. I think we need a producer. We might be looking at one here. Might have a tryout here. You might hear more about that in the future. But we had a mailbag. You post it. Sounds like it filled up. So why don't you give us the mailbag for the week?
It was bursting still from last week. We had a whole bunch of them that we recorded, and then we still had more come in afterwards. I didn't even have to open it up this week. So one of our previous guests asked, of all things, what's your go-to Starbucks order?
Nice.
Not a golf question, but hey, we like
any question, right? I think there's two ways to look at it. On the way to the golf course, you go by a Starbucks, right? You're on your way, maybe a morning round. For the morning, I like their dark roast or their Americano. They're dark, like the dark. It's so good. Bitter. Love it all. But afternoon, give me
is that what happens to you? You have that and you get bitter?
Oh, no. It's I need to. If not, I am bitter. Yeah. You do not want to. I need a coffee. I already went over this. Go back to the start of this episode.
You definitely need a coffee.
Afternoon, I'm a big caramel macchiato guy. It's ooh, just got a little
fancy.
I want some. I can't do just a black coffee. I drink my coffee black because I'm a man. And
thanks, Ron Swanson.
Yeah. And in the afternoon, I just need something different. I can't just do a black coffee in the afternoon. So a little caramel macchiato. What about you?
Okay. So I'm an Americano for sure. The funny part is that, you know, they need to juice it up for me. I'm kind of like a four-shot Americano guy in the morning.
Strong? How do I order it? Do you just order it strong?
Yeah, you just order it strong. I mean, so for most of the cases, they'll do two shots. Normal place that I go for a coffee, a local place or whatever, it's three shots or four shots, and I'm a four-shot guy or whatever. So it's especially helpful if you're going out to the Lesson Tee. or you're going out to cover a golf tournament and you kind of need a little pick me up or whatever. Only alternative, I guess, same kind of thing when you start to look at the afternoon or whatever. Obviously, I'm not chugging back Americanos in the afternoon or whatever, but I'll do a chai latte.
Oh,
fancy. Yeah, go a little tea. Oh, so, yeah, something different. Chai latte. So, not into my the caramelly, toffees, yeah, that okay. stuff. So,
whatever, man.
Move yeah. on. Big cup of sugar. All right, on to number two. What is your preferred golf shoe brand and why?
I'm a big Nike guy. I think you probably know that. I love the style of it. I grew up with Nike. Literally grew up with Nike. If you think about the way that brand blew up through the 80s and 90s and everything. Though I really like G4 stuff. I've never actually had it worn them, but they look great. But for me, I just find the fit and the comfort for me are Nikes. And then some of the more casual foot joys of recently have been catching my eye, but haven't had any. But if I'm actually purchasing the golf shoe, I think if I'm buying it, it right now is Nike until somebody can get me to change my mind on that. That's where I'm going. Yeah.
You know what? I love golf shoes. We've talked about that on the show here before. You're pretty much the same. And
12 pairs, 13 pairs, something like that.
Style is one thing. I'm not even going to get into it. Style is one thing. Fits the other thing as well. I mean, it's trying to get something. I've got a bit of a narrow foot with a high arch. So, you know, if I get shoes that are kind of too wide and too blocky, you know what? I'll end up tying my shoelaces every, 50 feet. So there's no point of that one. FootJoy's for me, probably number one brand. And I would say Adidas. I used to wear a fair bit of Nike stuff, but I found some of them, I like the style of them, but I didn't find I got the support that I wanted. So I sort of changed over the years as far as the style and fit that I wanted. So pretty traditional as far as the shoes, but there are so many good ones out there, but
they want to change our mind, right? I know we're fine. We will wear anything.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was our preferred. It's just a preference. Preferences change. You're a chai tea latte in the afternoon guy right now.
Right. That could change. I could be a caramel macchiato guy.
If somebody's buying you caramel macchiatos a bunch, you might change your mind. You never know.
All right, on to something that's a little bit more local. Now, I know the guy that asked this question does not live around this area, but obviously believes that we are close to the national capital region of Canada. Asked what our top five courses would be to play in Ottawa. So I don't know if he's going to travel there, so I don't know if they need to be public, but I'm not going to take it that way. I'm just going to say, what are your top five?
If we're not sure, we're answering the question you gave us.
Yeah, exactly.
You got to learn how to ask a better question. If you want public or private, why don't we go back and forth and we'll just go first five and we'll go. It's almost like a snake draft, and maybe we'll miss out on something in the end. Number one, I'm going to go with Eagle Creek. If you can get on Eagle Creek, I loved Eagle Creek.
Yeah,
such a fun golf course. Actually, if you play,
when was the last time you played there?
Oh, it's been a couple of years. Hey,
yeah. You know. So they're making a lot of renovations there. Taking down a lot of trees and stuff.
Okay,
it looks good though.
Invites dropped out. They are on PGA Tour 2K21. You can find it down there. Eagle Creek, loved Eagle Creek. That was a great golf course.
I like Eagle Creek, that's for sure. I'm going to start first off. Ooh, I enjoy playing Rideau View. It's a private club down in Manotick. Love the renovation work that Ian Andrew has done there. Playable, just love the club, really is the big thing, and enjoy the course, just the setting, kind of a lot of things. It's not just strictly architecture. It's a lot of other things that go with it. So that's number one for me. How's that?
Awesome. All right, so we got our top two. My third, you're going to have to head out, but I love Equinel. I think it's so much fun. It's a great course. It's fun. It's forgiving off the tee. The greens are rock hard, lightning fast, always in perfect condition. There's holes to score on. There's holes you got to shape it. Love it. Equinel.
Ditto.
No, you gotta go three. It's our two. It's our two. Yeah. It's our third. You got to pick our fourth. You agree with it, but you got to come up with a fourth.
Yeah. You know what? I'm gonna go Camelot. I enjoy playing Camelot. I like the elevation. It's a Tom McBroom design. Been around since the early 1990s. It's not for everyone, but I like the elevation that's there. I like the variety of holes. There's a couple of the holes that bite me in the butt every time that I play there, 16 particularly. Played the Pro there last year. Unfortunately, they had some issues, or the year before, had some issues with the greens and stuff, but I know it's come back and it's in great shape. And I like playing there. I don't know if you've ever played there, but, you know, we got to put it on the agenda.
Invite hasn't been sent. The invite has been sent to this one. I haven't played it, but it is my fifth one. Our friends over at Bush Bomb. I don't know if you've checked out Bush Bomb yet. You would have saw them on Dragon's Den.
Yeah, for sure.
Local to the area as well. A couple entrepreneurs. One of the owners, David Gaylord, is a member out at the Hunt Club. I am now putting this out in the public that I've only heard great things. You invite me every year, and anytime I actually look to take up that invite, you ghost me. So here we are. I've pitched your product, which I'd love. And Hunt Club, I've only heard great things. They obviously host the LPGA every once in a while. Great 27 holes out there, I believe.
Yes,
good
there
practice
are.
Facilities. Sounds like they got good winter facilities as well. So I'm going to go with the Hunt Club, but let's make it six. That way we each have three.
All right. Other one I will throw out there. I will throw in Royal Ottawa. And Royal Ottawa, I like, especially from the standpoint of the history of that place. It's got a cool heritage, hosted the Canadian Amateur, you know, back in 16, I guess was the last time, but this is a place where Golf Canada was founded. The PGA of Canada was founded, dates back to 1891. Really cool layout, just a neat place to drive into, like the environment. You never know who you're going to run into there. And the golf course keeps getting better and better all the time. Neil Haworth, who's been on this podcast, did the redesign work there, and he's continuing to do the do work there. Done an amazing job on their practice facility, and they just keep getting better and better. So, I'll put that one out there.
I like it. And we know somebody out there too now.
We might.
So it might have to. Might have to be, you know, I feel like we're going to be scratching a lot of favors this summer to play some golf.
Well, you know what? I think we can get you out to a few places that you haven't been. How's that?
I like it.
All right. Let's move on to our next question here. Would a junior golfer be better off starting with a few clubs over a full set to learn how to play? You want that one or shall I? I'll take that one. you know what? They don't need a full set to be able to play. You know, go ahead with a few clubs to kind of get started. Make sure that they're suitable for them as far as light enough in weight, flexibility-wise, enough loft on the clubs. That's really important as far as the players are concerned. Let them be creative. You know what? I started with a 7-piece set. I didn't have many clubs in my bag, and you know, you had to hit a lot of shots with them. So there's nothing wrong with starting somebody with a half set.
Sorry, I was blowing my nose there. Had a little bit of
that. You look like you're in distress. So
couldn't even get to the microphone. I mean, what's a junior golfer? Is junior golfer like any age? Is that what they call it?
I guess. Maybe it's, you know, it could be. Let's just say they're like under 10 or something. But even if they're not a junior golfer, any golfer that's just starting, I mean, as long as they've got a club.
I think my goal this summer, I want to get a Sunday bag and play a couple half set rounds.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it really helps you, especially working shots with the wind and everything. Makes you get more creative a little bit.
Definitely.
I think it's fun. So I like your answer. I will accept it.
All right. We'll go with that. All right. If you could play a course that was all par threes, par fours, or fives, which would you prefer?
That's a good question. I like that. Par fives would be the longest golf course ever. That'd be exhausting. And I think par fives would get the most boring of them, right? Because a par five can be exciting if it's like reachable in two, but when there's a par five that's just like super long, like your driver 3-1, you're still holding like a 7-iron in your hand. It's really not that difficult. It's just boring.
That just becomes a par 3 is really what it
exactly. does. Exactly. It's just there's a couple holes in the air where it's like, that's just a bad par 3 if you look at it. It's just a harder way to get to your ball to where the par 3 is going to be. Par 3 courses are always fun, but they get a little old. I'm going to go par 4 courses. I think you can do the most with a par 4. You can have your short par 4 that's, you know, you can try to drive it and get into some trap. You have your standard par 4 where it's just a really good tee shot, and then, you know, you want to be in the right side of the hole so you can attack the green. Or you have your long, difficult par 4 where it's like you need a great drive and then you need an amazing second shot. If you do those two, usually it's rather forgiving once you get up there. I think there's more you can do. I think they're more fun. That's just my thought. I'm going par 4s.
All right. It's going to be fives for me. As much as you might find that that's long, I don't mind that.
It's going to be a long day.
I know, but you know what? For me, that's kind of where I sort of have an advantage in some cases because I can hit the ball a decent way, take advantage of it as far as the length, be able to go for some of the greens in two. If not, to find a strategy to be able to play it, because I'm a guy as well that, you know, I'll go back and play a par five and I might not hit driver off the tee. You know, if I sort of,
there's a couple there where, you know, if I think seven at like Loyalist, for example, seven at Loyalist,
you
almost shouldn't because there's trees on right. And I remember when I was, we were playing practice with Bo Hogue. Well, clearly good buds.
really tight.
I remember him, that was like a hole he remembered from the McKenzie tour. It was just like, he couldn't hit driver off. He's like, I think it's like a 6-iron one day. Because like,
really?
It makes sense. Yeah, like just a weird hole that way. But
yeah,
that's fair. I don't know.
But those are case. You know, that's the case. I mean, you know, and it's kind of funny when you play with somebody and you get to the hole and, you know, you all of a sudden you're standing there with a long iron off the tee and they're like, what are you doing? It's a par five. And you're like, well, I'm not planning to go for it. So I need to get it in the fairway where I want to be on the one side and then play it the other way. So for me, I think fives is more fun for me. But again, that's all a personal preference. But yeah, good question, though. I like that one.
Cool.
All right, last one here. What is your favorite type of alignment mark or none on a putter?
None for me.
None at all.
None at all is what I prefer. Or just a dot on the top where it's not. I'm not too focused on it. If I when the line gets in, it has a bad effect, and I think putting is the best part of my game. And I find the putters that I have no alignment on, I putt the best with, because I'm not overthinking it. I'm not trying to line it with my line I'm trying to get on. I'm a feel putter very much. So for me, none. I actually got a Scotty Cumming. I bought one off of Marketplace. Shout out to Dez's brother. Found a Newport for me with no weights, like an older Newport.
Oh, yeah.
And it's currently back with Scotty. It's going to cost me about $800 all said and done. But, hey, why not? Let's get one. Yeah. Let's get one refurbished. So I cannot wait to get that thing back.
That'll
be a gamer for sure.
Yeah, I'm real simple, but I'll go with just like a single line, and that's about it. Certainly have had some with just a dot over the years, but I don't want too much decoration that's up there. And I think you're right. All of a sudden, if you get too much as far as the alignment stuff, you become too dependent on that, and you get too focused on that. And we'll see that with golf balls, too.
Oh, like the Callaway putters with the Callaway lines
the
on.
With the True Track.
Oh, my God. I have a buddy. Like, this guy couldn't putt if the hole was the size of, like, you know, they do soccer golf.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he has the True Track. He gets the True Track balls and he lines it up. Like, dude, just close your eyes.
Does he have the putter and the ball?
Yeah. Okay. And he couldn't putt to save his life. It's like, dude, just close your eyes. You have just to get a shot at this point. So, those lines aren't doing anything for you.
Yeah, unfortunately, that could be the case for some. And you're right, some people just depend far too much on it. But thanks, everyone, for sending those questions in. We'll open up the mailbag again next week, see if we do it from voice notes, which we promised to do. But obviously, we had leftover questions. But keep them coming. We love your questions. We do not mind if it's about Starbucks orders or anything else. Ask us.
I actually prefer that.
Yeah, it's kind of fun to get questions like that. Keep them coming. We love your questions. We love to interact with the listeners. Hey, maybe we'll do something sometime. I see a lot of people using the Clubhouse app and a few other things now. Maybe we'll do a live session or something at some point, maybe an Insta Live or something.
We'll have like two viewers. It'll be unreal. Yeah,
that'll be awesome. We can pop on and we can talk a little bit.
I'm down
more
for an Insta Live. Maybe next week. Let's throw an Insta Live out there, see what happens. Yeah, might be embarrassing. Might be very humbling. I actually hopped in the Clubhouse the other day. I heard Christina Wong was in there with Mike from TXG, I believe, and they were in there. This was not a topic for radio. They're talking about some woman golfers' nude pictures being like released somehow. I was shocked hopping in there. This is not a place for me. These are my virgin ears. My virgin.
I'm not too familiar with the app or anything yet. I haven't really experienced or play around with it, but it looks interesting. And just like anything else, anything to be a little bit more social.
Yeah, why not? It's cool. I thought it was cool to hop in. Just quickly, you're talking about alignment on putters.
Yeah.
Did you ever have the guy or gal come into your shop that complained you didn't put their grip on right, and they would use the grip to align their hands on the golf clubs?
Oh, yeah. All the time.
The worst. It's like, if that is where your head is at, and I actually had a buddy, great buddy, and I luckily got him to change his mind. He's like, oh, I'm a little worried about this part. He's switching grips. He's very much a, you know, Golf Pride, Tour Velvet guy. He's been that way his whole life. And he's trying something different. He's like, I'm a little worried about this line up at the top. It's like, what is that line going to do? And then I think by just me asking, he's like, clearly nothing. Why am I worried about it? He ended up ordering some tackier grips. I think he gets a little sweaty in the summer. If you are the person that looks at your grip to put your hand on the club, you're in trouble. You can't be good. Like, do you know somebody that is like a single digit handicap that literally has to put their hand based on a logo on the grip?
I used to have one customer that used to come in the store, and great guy. He used to drive in maybe an hour and a half to come and visit the shop, and we would do his grips. And I've never seen somebody more anal about their grip. So I got used to it, but everything had to be perfect. And that's, again, fine. That's your prerogative as the customer. But he would sit there. We'd pre-measure. We'd have to pre-weight everything. Every single wrap had to be perfect. No bubbles in the grips. I mean, or in the tape. There's just like everything had to be as perfect as possible. And he would just inspect it. So we knew that. We knew that was the standard that we had to do for him. And obviously, we tried as much as possible to make sure.
You shut down the shop that day? Like, hey, I can't work. I can't talk to anyone else.
Pretty much. He's like the guy I talked about last year that came in and took him all day to pick out a glove. That's just the way it is. So, unfortunately, that was just his deal as far as alignment on his grips.
Yeah. So that's my tip of the week. If you stop caring about your grips, just like put a grip on, put a logo down. Makes life way easier.
That's
my tip of the week. What's yours, Scotty?
My tip of the week is there's more to spin than just buying a new wedge. I hear people all the time, talking about wedges and saying, hey, you know what? I need more control. I'm going to go buy a new wedge. Well, guess what? There's more than just a new wedge. Now, that's helpful, but it's only part of the formula. There's a lot of things that go into controlling spin and doing things around the green on top of, you know, proper trajectory and so forth. But in your pitch shots, there's a lot of things that you have to look at with your coach. You got to understand a lot of factors like loft, angle of attack, spin loft, speed, impact location, grooves, ball type, club design, friction. Everything makes a difference. They're all factors that are in there. So what I would say is don't just expect that if you go buy a new wedge, it's going to change everything for you. Dive in with your coach and somebody who's qualified as far as a fitter is concerned. You can get better control of your wedges in 2021. And I guarantee you, the more that you dive into it and the better that you understand what the tool is about and how you can make use of it better, it's going to be less important of the brand and the style of wedge that you buy and more of how you use it. And I'm not saying that, you know, certain wedges that you buy are not going to make a difference. Guarantee you will. Things like bounce make a huge difference as far as where the strike point is on a wedge and make a big difference as far as what spin occurs as a result of it. But there's a lot more factors that you can control than just the tool that you're using to get the right amount of spin that you need to control your shots.
I like it. TLDR, go get fit for the right wedges.
You got it.
Scotty, what do you got going on the rest of the week? You know, it's a fun week. I think we both love the LA Open, if for the lack of better terms here.
I'll always call Genesis, the LA Open. The Genesis Invitation.
All right. Yeah. It's hosted by Tiger Woods. That's not playing. I always love this week. What's the better hole for you, 10 or 18?
10, always 10. You know, even when I was there in 15 to go watch it, I spent more time on 10 than I did on anything. 18's great. It's a cool amphitheater. when you get up on the clubhouse and look down there, it's really good. But it's standing on the tee at 10 or standing down by the green, watching these players go for it and seeing what kind of mess of trouble that they will get into on this golf hole that's barely over 300 yards. And you'll see the 300,
I think it's
world.
Like 20 something down too. So it's like,
exactly.
So it's a weird one where you're not really getting 3 wood there. Right. So you gotta almost take some off the driver for a lot of those guys out there.
Yeah, and it's such a the green has no depth to it at all. It's got that bunker in the front, really challenging. You just, you know, great players all of a sudden get brought to their knees by a hole that, you know, is not very long at all. So I would stay there all the time and watch that. But yeah, it'll be fun to see who plays well. Great field there. A lot of the top players, 8 of the top 10 players in the world in the field this week. So it should be fun. You going to watch it a bit?
Oh, I'm going to. I'm looking forward to it. It's a great golf course. It's always in immaculate condition. It always is exciting at the end. Scores are not usually that low. You should keep it tough out there. I was just thinking, too. So the course I've played at for the last number of years is called Loyalist out in Bath. And the way that green is designed at 10, if they almost turned 11 into like a short par 4 instead of like a long par 3.
And turned it sideways.
Like turned sideways, like push the tee back there. Because I have a feeling if you ever played out there, 18 is going to have to be a par 4 soon. They're building houses like...
snap back hook. To what it was because it was a par 4 when it started.
They are building houses in snap hook territory all over. Right, like it doesn't matter what tee you're at, there's gonna be snap hook potential into somebody's yip, not even in their living room. Like people barbecuing are gonna need to
that's not
gonna
good.
Be yelling for. So I have a feeling, and if they want to stay as a 72, I think it's an awful par 3, but it would be a great par 4. Push it back into the trees a little bit, make you shape the ball into it, get in a lot of trouble. I think it'd be great, but hey, what do I know? I just know designers. I'm not actually one.
You know what? It's a unique design that they've got there, the 10th of Riviera. And I think, you know, everybody really talks about it. And there's a lot to that golf course. I mean, you know, it's the Hollywood sort of scene and the Humphrey Bogart stuff that you hear about. And it's that Hollywood mystique. And, you know, it's in Pacific Palisades, but it's got a cool look as far as that clubhouse is concerned up on the hill. And yeah, I mean, when we were there in 15, they had telescopes up on the deck. And you'd be up there and looking at the stars, which, you know, was kind of cool. And that's just the way it is. It's just a cool Hollywood type era place. And I think the players enjoy playing there. They know it's a special place. And, you know, they're in L.A., so they loved going out for dinner. You know, you'll see the players out for dinner in Rodeo Drive. And
maybe not right now, not in California.
No, not as much. Yeah. But normally, in most cases, they like to go there for that purposes. Just to go out and head to the steakhouses and all the great sushi restaurants and stuff like that. So, it'll be fun to watch.
You want to make it interesting this week? I got a little game we could play. Say $25 each. We each will do a snake draft, 3 players, but one of our players have to win. Neither of them win, no money exchange. Maybe we'll do that. Maybe we'll throw that in the mix each week.
All right.
I'll let you have first pick since I threw you on this out of nowhere.
I will take DJ. He's had 9 top 10s there, 5 top 6s, I believe. So he's my guy, number 1. I get first pick. I'm taking him.
Oh, of course. I'm going to go with...
I know who you're going to say.
No, you don't. I got a couple here that I'm looking at. I'm going to take Rory.
Okay.
Who are you thinking? Who are you thinking?
No, I thought you were going to take Will Zalatoris because you were talking him. I thought, man, is he going to take a flyer and take
right
Zalatoris?
Off one with Zalatoris? I can't do that.
I don't know.
It's impressive this kid's in the field, man.
Yeah.
A year ago, he had zero status on the web.com.
I think that time I was there, he was there as a college player because I can remember seeing him play on the range. He got one of the exemptions or something. So, but yeah, it is pretty impressive. Number 2 for me.
Was that a G note you just hit? A D?
No, for me. God, I'm trying to think of the player, thinking of the style of play there. Got some good Canadians here, but I don't know if those guys will do. Let's go Matt McNeely, who played well last week, got in the mix, looked like he was going to do something. He's a little bit of a flyer, but why not? I'll go Matt McNeely as my number 2 guy.
All right, I'm going Bubba Watson, number 2. Ooh. This guy's won here 3 times?
Loves that place.
2 or 3 times?
2, I think.
Just had an article come out. Basically, it's okay not to be okay, talking about his mental health struggles, and hasn't won since 2018. Been struggling with his health since. Great article. Hope he got that off his chest. I think he plays well this week. Going Bubba Watson.
All right. So my last one. Wow. You already took Rory. I'm trying to think of guys that have played well there and are feeling it. It's a certain style of golf course too, though. So there's certain players I just don't think will do well there. I'll go, you know what? Spieth has played well the last couple of weeks. I think I might as well jump on that train and I'll take Spieth.
I like it. My guy's kind of in that same boat. Tony Finau. Oh, one of these guys. That's a good one too. Who breaks through between these two? Maybe we should have a separate bet of who wins first, and we'll each take those two. I like this. This is a cool little game. We'll see who wins next week. Probably I have a feeling neither of us will win, and we'll see how far this goes, and could be a little fun game for each week. But until then, we're going to wrap it up. Enjoy the LA Open, the Genesis Invitational, the Tiger Woods Championship, whatever you want to call it, at Riviera. We will chat with you next week.